Morning. This is House Fisheries, and it is 10:03. We will come to order in room 120 on Thursday, February 11th, 2016. Members present are Representative Ortiz, Representative Millett, and myself, Chair Stutes. We also are joined by Kelly Burnett of House Records, Matt Kern from the LIO, and my Fisheries Committee aide, Reed Harris. And I would like to wish Representative Millett a happy birthday today. Today is the second hearing for House Bill 251, Electronic Tax Returns and Fishery Taxes. We'll begin with a presentation by the department to address the questions raised during this bill's last hearing. We will follow up with further public testimony and then set this bill aside until next week. So if I could have someone from the department come up, please identify yourself, your affiliation, and begin.
Certainly. Good morning, Madam Chairman. My name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. So I believe the committee has a letter signed by Deputy Commissioner Burnett that was sent over last night or this morning. I'm not exactly sure the format you'd like to go through. I could certainly read through the letter, or you could rephrase the questions. I could answer them on the record. How would you like to structure this?
Why don't we just go through the questions and you can answer them. Who is defined as a processor, and can we see a list of taxpayers for the fishery business tax and resource landing tax and get a better understanding of exactly who is paying tax and who is not?
Certainly, Madam Chair. First off, to skip to the second part, we really were not able to provide a list of taxpayers. That's considered confidential information. We can't provide a complete list of who all is our licensed processors, but most of them are relatively well known, although we also license direct marketers as processors, and that they pay fish tax under this structure as well. There are some statutory definitions. Row recovery from salmon caught from a vessel greater than 65 feet in length. You know, like generally speaking, if it's anything other than heading getting done on board the boat, it's calculated as processing. Defined as any activity that modifies the physical condition of the fishery resource. What isn't considered processing is heading getting, gilling, icing seafood products, or decapitating fish. I couldn't tell you the difference between heading and decapitating, although it is in statute. Processors include...
Representative Millett has a question for you.
Good to see you, Ken. Just to go back to your statement, so you can't tell us the name of the company that paid taxes to the state of Alaska? Is that what you're telling me, that you don't have a list of taxpayers to the state of Alaska when it comes to processors?
Through the chair, Representative Miller, of course we have a list. It's a question of taxpayer confidentiality. And in many ways, we are bound by the IRS's rules. What's considered taxpayer confidential information includes their name if it comes to us in the context of their paying their taxes. And we aren't actually able to publish lists of who our taxpayers are.
Okay, that's very interesting. I had no idea you couldn't do that.
Through the chair, Representative Miller, I assure you it's not unique to fish.
We've had this conversation when it comes to oil tax and mining, too. So I just thank you for jarring my memory.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alper, on this defined characteristics of a processor, do all five of these bullet points have to be met before they're considered a processor and therefore taxable, or two of these, or how does that work?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'm fairly certain it's any one of them, although I might not be the ideal person to answer that question. I'm going to look behind me at Deputy Commissioner Brooks for a little bit of a lifeline if he knows. Okay, or Commissioner Cotton's there too, look at that. Yes, any one of them should qualify you as a processor.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
And while you can't share with us in the list of those people who fall under that category, and we can appreciate that need for confidentiality, any revenue action that, you know, that we may or may not take, the ultimate goal would be to, of course, if we take it, to enhance revenue. Are you fairly confident that you are capturing that group of people that are doing these types of activities, that you're capturing the broad scope of those folks?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, one thing we did provide to the committee a couple of days ago was a list that broke down current tax collections by tax category. You know, we talked in the previous hearing the 3%, the 4.5%, the 5%, and the 1% categories. So obviously that is amalgamated, aggregated from a broader set of, a more precise set of data that we have. We are prepared to provide aggregated data in lots of other different ways. We provided information, for example, on our mining tax that broke out the number of taxpayers by range of income. So, you know, we can't talk about individuals, but if we can cluster them together in some rational format, we could do our best to provide information to give some insight as to who we're talking about.
Thank you.
Thank you. Moving on to the next question. What's the origin of the separate FBT rate for salmon canneries?
Madam Chairman, we looked into that and we found some historic references. It's been that way forever, for as long as we've been taxing fish in Alaska. If you go back deep enough into the past, that I'm not going to pretend to be a fish commercial fisheries historian, but the bulk of the processing, so to speak, was the canneries, and then there was a cold storage fee for those fish that were put into cold storage and shipped out that way. The rates for the different sectors moved around over time, and they just sort of settled to where they are sometime in recent decades. But canneries were always treated differently from cold storages, and then suddenly, as more and more of the fish is getting value-added processing other than canning, it's just that it falls into a different category. I could not tell you where that 4.5% came from. The legislature raised it from 3% to 4.5% in 2004. It had been 3% from 1967 until 2004. That's a very long period of time. We could perhaps go back to the committee record from a dozen years ago to see where that rationale came from. My guess is it was a 50% increase in a time of another time of budget shortfall.
Are there any questions? Thank you. How does the Department of Fish and Game determine what is a developing or established fishery?
So I'm going to, Madam Chair, start this, and then I will authentically reach out for the lifeline. What the statute says is that the Commissioner of Fish and Game shall provide to the Department of Revenue by January 31st a list of all the developing fisheries. Those result from their internal process, which I presume to be a science-driven process as to what's a fishery that's first being harvested, that's not being raised, that they're trying to get off the ground as a commercial fishery. They give us that information so that we know what rate to tax people at. But ultimately, the managers, the Department of Fish and Game, makes that determination. We have the list, meaning we've received the list. I don't have it with me, although I believe our friends from Fish and Game might.
Yes.
Oh, then it's in the packet that was submitted to you. And if we page back, look at that. There's a January 27th memo from Commissioner Cotton to Commissioner Hoffbeck that lists the various fisheries, Atkamat, Grell, Arrowtooth Flounder, this other flatfish definition, Ling Cod. And you can see looking through that, these are not big dollar items. If you look at the report that we sent the committee on a breakdown of revenue by tax category, out of the 25 or so million dollars the state received in general funds from the fisheries business and landing tax, the developing fisheries were something like $200,000 of it. It was a relatively small number within the overall portfolio.
Thank you. Any questions from this committee? Thank you. Why are charter boats not subject to this tax?
Madam Chairman, as we put in the letter, there is no reason why we couldn't add a tax on charter fisheries. The sport fish landings aren't accounted for in the same way. There isn't a fish ticket system. There isn't the precision of harvest. This tax, as written, is very much written around the nature of the commercial fishing industry, the commercial fishing process, how things are valued and so forth. if we would like to come up with a tax on charter fisheries and sport caught fish or fish processed at lodges, that sort of thing, that would be something we can help you put together, but it'd be very hard to build it within AS 43, 75, and 77, which are very much written to be commercial fisheries type taxation.
Thank you. And I'd like to take a moment to recognize Representative Foster. And Representative Ortiz, you had a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alpert, you referenced it at the very end of your answer there. So you're saying that you would take further legislative action or put into place some regulations in order to see that happen, yet I know of... you know, there's some specific lodge activities where much of those the definitions of prepares, processes, or stores a fishery resource, those kinds of things happen already at significant levels in certain parts of the states. So my question is, if any of these things qualify for a processor, why wouldn't we be able to use the existing legislation to start to perhaps collect some revenue from some of these locations where that processing takes place, such as at lodges, etc.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, and it gets dangerous when someone starts to speculate, but I'm going to speculate a little bit here. When you're dealing with commercial fisheries, someone is selling that fish, and therefore the fish has a value, and it's an excise tax. So you put a percentage of that value, and we charge a tax. If what a charter operator does, or what a lodge has, they provide a service of giving you access to the fishery, and then the person catches the fish themselves, and are very much restricted from selling it. You know, it's quite explicit that you can't take your sport or personally use fish and sell it. Therefore, it would be hard in the context of our law to value it for tax purposes. Right? That, my guess is that's a big piece of why we need that separation.
I guess to follow that up, I would ask, isn't it being processed if it's being cleaned and packaged for the individual to take with them?
Madam Chairman, it is being processed. I don't believe that that is the only requirement. I think somewhere along the line it also needs to it needs to be valued. It needs to be sold. And I can't answer that with much more detail. We should get someone up here who could answer that question. And if you're going to recalendar this bill, I'll make sure we can answer this in greater detail. Our statutes are written very much as, once again, commercial fisheries statutes.
That would be wonderful. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. So I presume this would fall under that same category when we're asking, let's see. Oh, I guess. Well, what's the distribution of the $18 million in new fish tax revenue under House Bill 251?
So, Madam Chairman, we put a table in there that adds up to $18.4 million. The number varies from year to year if you look at the fiscal note, but $18 million is sort of the rounded placeholder number we're using for the overall fiscal plan. The largest number is the pollock at $5.4 million, other ground fish $3.2, salmon $4.9 million, shellfish $2.6, and some smaller numbers. And that's purely by taking our existing collections and recalculating them as if the tax were the 1% higher. So
you
could see from that, you know, order of magnitude where we're getting our existing fish tax revenue.
So what is the distribution of the $140 million in budget cuts under the governor's bill?
Madam Chairman, that should be in this packet. There's a large table from the Department of Fish and Game here on the, it appears to be the second to last page, and I'm looking at it. I'll hold up to you, Madam Chairman, the second to last page of the packet. It's a very small font. If you look at the second column, which is FY 2016 management plan, effectively current year budget, and then FY 17 governor, the third column is what's proposed in the governor's budget. You could see all the subcategories and how it breaks out, and the bottom line number agency operating has gone from 4.10 million to 3.95 million. That is, that's billions. I thought this was a summary of Fish and Game. So there's Fish and Game. It's going, you know what? I'm looking at this for the first time, I'll be honest with you, and it's not my department. Why don't we get someone from Fish and Game up here to talk about their budget?
Great. Good morning. Could you identify yourself for the record and your affiliation, please?
Certainly, Madam Chair. Kevin Brooks, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Fish and Game. Actually, the table that refers to the breakout of the $140 million is the second from the last page of the packet. Mr. Elper was doing a fine job with it until the very end there. But he does talk about the 16 management plans, the second column. The 17 governor's numbers are in the third column. And the difference is by department, how if you get down to about the middle of the page, you can see $540,671.1. That is the sum total of $140 million in cuts in the governor's budget by department and category. And this is a document from, it's not a department generated one, from it's from the Office of Management and Budget. It's been part of Director Pat Pitney's presentations before both bodies.
And apparently the last page is the actual cuts to the Department of Fish and Game?
Correct, Madam Chair. So if you look still on the one page, you can see the fourth line, it's Fish and Game, it's $7,454.9. That's the cut to the department. And so the last page breaks that out further. We've showed you not only the 17 cut with the $7,454.9, but also the amount taken in FY16, which was $14,292,000.
Representative Ortiz.
So, thank you, Kevin. I'm looking at this same sheet, the third page there. So it's safe to say, I'm interpreting this the right way, that from FY2015 to the proposed governor's budget, if in fact that was adopted by the legislature, the Fish and Game would be down $21,747,000.
That's correct, through the chair, Representative Ortiz.
And that would be, in essence, looking at FY 2015, you're at $79,387,000. So you're looking at about a 25% cut in relationship to where we were in 2015. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that's correct. And the purpose for putting this before the committee was to kind of put, I think there's interest that the state agencies are also reducing their budgets before we're discussing any taxes. This puts it in a context of what an $18 million fiscal note of increased revenue would mean compared to cuts that the department has been taking. And so we've provided that for the body.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Hey, good to see you, Kevin. Just a couple questions about, since we've gone to the budget and we're talking about the budget, can you talk to me about your test fisheries and how much test fisheries cost to operate and why that's not privatized, and are you generating money from that catch of the test fisheries? And if we're going to talk about budget cuts, I'd like to just point out a couple of things. How many boats does Fish and Game own, and how many test fisheries do you have boats in, and why aren't you having, I know in Bristol Bay you have people that do test fisheries for you, but you do also have your own boats that you're doing your own test fisheries on, and can you talk to me about that?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative Millett, the department does a fair amount of test fishing. Mm-hmm. There's two types we categorize it. One is where we'll use a combination of either our own boats or we do charter. But we're out doing assessments on stocks. Maybe it's on herring to see if the roe is mature enough to turn on the fishery. And when we do that, the sets we take, we have fish, we have dead fish, and we sell those under a fish ticket. And those are truly assessment-type projects. Mm-hmm. And we have revenue fisheries. And these are the ones that generate a little bit more interest, if you will. It creates tension between the department and the fleet to some extent. And this is where we're out fishing, say Bristol Bay, and we go out and fish before the fishery opens to generate revenue to pay for management of that fishery. And so I don't have the exact number, but from memory it's about $3.5 million in the department's budget is test fish receipt authority. And that's a combination of both our assessment test fishing and our revenue test fishing. We've seen that number fluctuate over time. During the early 2000s, through a period of general fund spending growth, we had far less test fishing going on because a lot of those projects were moved to the general fund. As general fund budgets have gotten tighter, and when they've gotten tighter in the past, we've done more test fishing. And it's something we work with industry on. We're proposing $800,000 more in test fishing receipt authority in the 17 budget. It's spread across the region. And in fact, for our budget subcommittees, we've provided a list of all the test fishing across all the regions, and we'd be happy to give that to the committee. But we meet, for instance, now I think there's $200,000 proposed for Prince William Sound, and so we're meeting with commercial fishermen to determine where it's best to do that, how to provide the, you know, how to have the least impact on the fisheries. But it is the department, either in its own boats or more commonly in a charter boat, putting someone out in front of the fleet to generate revenue to pay for the management of the fisheries.
And so in your, I haven't looked at your detail book in a couple of weeks, but do you have that laid out as far as what the state of Alaska owns as far as fishing vessels and test boats? Do you have? Can you give me a breakdown of gear of all the actual capital investments we've made for boats and gear and for fishing?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, we have 6 research vessels. Their primary purpose is not test fishing, but it is assessment and other types of work. We can certainly provide you with a list and value and those kinds of things.
Okay.
Are those research vessels also the vessels that do the fishing? Or do you have separate vessels that do the fishing, the test fishing? Or
Representative Stutz, any test fishing done by the department would be off of these boats.
Okay.
Primarily, though, we do contracts with fishermen to do charters to do that test fishing for us.
The test fishing that generates revenue for you?
Yes.
And when you do that, are you doing that test fishing during regular open season, or can you do it before the actual season opens?
We are out there in the case of Bristol Bay, where I'm familiar, we're out before the opening, before the fleet is going to work on the fish. We're a day or two early doing that test, or a week doing that test fishing and generating revenue.
So let me get this clear. The Department of Fish and Game has boats that they go out and do test fishing for revenue before the fleet has an opportunity to. Is that correct?
In the case we're talking about, again, I don't think we're using a Fish and Game vessel in Bristol Bay. I think we're hiring a charter out there.
Okay. Excuse me. I believe Commissioner Cotton has something to add to this.
The other thing I'd like to put into some context, and then I'll pull back here so the commissioner can move in. A large portion of the test fish revenue that we generate is on the crab out in Westward Alaska. We are doing test fishing on salmon stocks as well, but the significant portion of the revenue is derived from crab test fishing. And we'll provide the list and the various fisheries that occur across each region and get that to you today. It's something
I presume a lot of that has to do with the high value of the crab. So you fish less for more money.
Can I ask one more question?
You may. Representative Millett.
Thank you. And Kevin, have you looked at the possibility, instead of the state owning those vessels, we don't need them year-round, I'm assuming, is there opportunity to lease those at a less expensive cost so we're not paying the full cost of maintenance and year-round?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, we have looked at chartering, and actually we do a fair amount of chartering. We do aircraft and vessel chartering, but we spend probably $4 million a year on chartering. So the vessels we have, the large research vessels, they tend to be out at sea for 100 to 120 days a year. The times we need them, It's hard to get boats because it's the same time people that have a vessel of that size, they're using them as well. So it's our efforts in that regard are a mix of our own vessels and charter vessels, and we have looked at trying to do it completely with charters, and it hasn't been feasible up till now. And
can you, to the chair,
one more.
Can you get that comparison for me? I'd like to see the research that you've done on leases versus owning the fishing vessels, and then the time that you use the vessels, and look at opportunities for people that do have fishing vessels that are out there that aren't using them.
We'll get that to the
And camera. Along those lines, I know that you have, or I believe you have, two fishing game vessels ported out of Kodiak.
We have the Resolution.
The Wolstead?
No.
Well, that's a trooper boat, isn't it? Okay.
The Resolution is the only vessel
right.
we have. There.
Excuse me. Okay, and Commissioner Cotton, did you have something to add?
Just to supplement some of the remarks already made here as far as test fishing is concerned, and there's a variety of opportunities that we take to do the test fishing, and for example, I was out in Bristol Bay this year to observe the fishery, and if you're familiar with Bristol Bay, you know you've got Naknek, and then you've got Igigik, and there's a space in between that is typically or often closed, so that's where we had a chartered fishing vessel fishing in that closed area. And so fishing was taking place up at Naknek and at Igigik, but our test vessel was fishing at the same time, but in an area that would have been closed to other fishermen. And that was, a chartered boat. And there's a couple of functions there in addition to just revenue. I mean, we do get indications of run timing, run strength, so there is other information you get. But the legislature gives us specific authority to receive those receipts from the test fishery. So it's a dual purpose, but certainly revenue is one of the issues there. One of the policies the department tries to follow is to use those dollars generated in that particular area if possible. Same, we have a lot of management responsibility with crab, even though it's a federally controlled fishery. We do the management, so that's another area where we'll be able to enjoy some revenue from that to compensate our expenses there. So that's and then on the on our vessels, I think Deputy Commissioner Brooks explained that you know the cost analysis is constantly being looked at because if it was obviously cheaper to just charter instead of owning boats, I think we'd be very interested in doing that. But again, it's not an automatic lower cost on a charter vessel. So you'll see different applications. Down here, you got the Kestrel that's homeported out of Petersburg, and they do a lot of work with dive fisheries, with herring fisheries, so they're bouncing around a lot of different areas, and it's probably cheaper to own our own vessel in that case.
I would presume, and maybe wrongly, so maybe I should make this a question instead of a statement, that you have some kind of control of what your catch is, and I would guess it would be by way of fish tickets? How do you control or how do you keep a record of what you catch and where when you're doing your test fisheries?
Well, you can answer that.
Yeah.
I assume that the department's got a card that we, mm-hmm. that we use, and there's a fish ticket
yes.
recording it.
Could you
so the department has, we record it on a department ticket, fish ticket, that's correct.
Could you provide this committee a copy of a record of the department's catch for, say, the last 5 years?
Yeah.
In the test fisheries. Thank you. Do we have any other questions from this committee?
I do.
Yeah. Oh, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Cotton, please finish your comments.
Would it be okay if I made just a couple other comments on the earlier questions?
Let's get Representative Millett's question first, and then you can have the floor.
Thanks, Commissioner. I wanted to know, and I haven't been able to find. Are you proposing more test fisheries to increase revenue that may take opportunity away from commercial fishermen in any commercial fishing arena? Are you proposing more test fisheries for revenue generation? Is what I'm trying to ask you.
Through the chair, Representative Millett, in the 17 budget, there's a $800,000 proposal to backfill a general fund cut with $800,000 of test fish revenue. So that is, and we have half a dozen different fisheries that would be applied to, and that's part of the information that I'll be providing to the committee. So it'd be the existing money in there as well as this $800,000 that we're proposing for 17. And the point I'd like to make on this, too, is we don't like doing test fishing. I mean, that's not something we go looking for. It's out of necessity, and it is with some level of consultation with the industry, but it's not something we enjoy doing. I guess I would leave it at that.
So along those lines, then, let me just ask this. In these cuts from the state and the financial that you provided to this committee, is that $800 million reflected in this? $800,000.
Representative Stutz, the $800,000 would reduce that $7.4 million cut that the department has. So through the proposal of using test fish, we'll take that $7.4 million cut to, say, $6.6 million instead.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. First a comment and then, I guess, a question. I often hear from fishermen in my district about how we have, in the state of Alaska, one of the best examples of how to manage fisheries around the world, and they have so they have that reputation, and when we look at the GF reductions that have taken place over the last 2 years, I can't help but think that their ability to sustain their mission with this kind of reduction has got to be jeopardized. There's just no way that it can't be jeopardized. So then the question then is, I guess the question is, it's safe to say that these fisheries, these test fisheries that you're proposing, are both based on the need to gather data and to get information about the fish that are out there, and then also to augment some of these cuts that you've taken in order for you to fulfill that basic mission. Is that safe to say?
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Millett.
What are you testing for? What $800,000 increase are you testing for when you go out and take fishermen out of commercial fishermen's hands into government? And I understand you're trying to pay for something, but you also have to understand that we've got fishermen out there that are going fishing for their livelihood, and $800,000 is a small amount of test fishery, and you're testing, you call it a test fishery, but what you're doing is you're catching fish to pay for government, which is competing with private sector commercial fishermen out there that are trying to make a living. And I'm just trying to make sure we are understanding that this is a revenue generator. This is not, you're not testing the fish. You are catching the fish to fill revenue in Fish and Game's budget. And so I just want to be clear, because it's not all testing. It is called a test fishery, but you are catching fish to make money. And so there is a small component of that, which you do fin testing and you do scale testing and you do, you know, there's a lot of science that goes into it, but I just want to be clear, because when people are listening to this conversation in the public, I fished for some time and saw the test boats out there, and they're catching a lot more fish than they need to be testing. And you're catching 10,000 pounds before anybody else is fishing, or 5,000 pounds or 100,000 pounds before a fishery opens. That is the state is commercial fishing. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is this is not a test fishery. This is the state of Alaska being a commercial fisherman also. Is that a good, fair display of what we're talking about here?
Commissioner Cotton, please.
Thank you. And what we're going to do is provide you a list of the different fisheries and how much each contributes to the test fish receipts that the legislature authorizes. But it just depends on how you describe it. What you're saying is that the state is commercial fishing. We're putting boats in the water for the sole purpose of generating revenue. And we are doing that to some extent. But we are also doing test fishing for other purposes, like the herring fishery, like the crab fishery, like the even the salmon fishery. There are other benefits to that test fishing, and as I mentioned earlier, for run timing and run strength are a couple of the benefits from it. But in direct answer to your question, there is some strictly revenue generating involved, no doubt about it. But it's not solely for revenue generation. There's a combination of benefits.
Representative Ortiz.
And is it also safe to say with these reductions in general that in some cases, in some situations, in areas where perhaps some of these streams are not high prioritized, you are not getting some of the data that you need to get, and so therefore your fish allotment counts either have been or maybe in the future, fish allotment catch counts, I should say, may need to be reduced purely because you need to be more conservative because you don't have the data and you want and you have that mission of sustaining the fishery. So therefore, your fish allotment counts have to be reduced. So therefore, the fishermen are impacted that way too. They're not allowed to catch potentially what they could catch if you had that data available to you. Is that correct?
Commissioner Sutton, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ortiz, as a general principle, that's absolutely correct. The Department of Fish and Game has got a lot of missions, but one of them is to protect fish and make sure that we have a sustained yield and that we are conservative in our approach. And as we have information that's no longer available to us, we are automatically going to have to be more conservative. So your point is correct. As a general principle, less information gives us less precision in our management, and that usually results in a more conservative approach and less access to the resource.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, I will now open this for public testimony. Do we have anyone in-house that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, we will go first to the Kodiak LIO, and we have Oliver Holm on the line. Mr. Holm, can you hear us?
I can hear you fine. You hear me?
Yes, if you could speak up just a little more and identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
My name is Oliver Holm, and I'm a commercial fisherman in the Kodiak region, and I'm representing myself. As a commercial fisherman, and I'm not a processor, the tax you're considering is paid by the processor, but it's based on my ex vessel value. But I want to dispel the idea that maybe commercial fishermen aren't paying taxes, because there's just a large number. I paid $1,059 for my vessel and permit renewals this last season. But the raw fish tax the processor pays, which indirectly comes to my income, is 3% or more, depending on the category. I'm paying a 1.075% landing tax on everything I catch to the borough, Kodiak Island Borough, a 2% salmon enhancement tax that goes to the state, then back to the Salmon Enhancement Association. I'm paying 3% this last year for my to NMFS for my halibut IFQ tax. And then there's an additional NMFS observer tax. Of course, we pay city sales taxes on all the purchases and taxes. I've got federal income tax, there's a borough vessel tax, and the state fuel tax. There gets to be quite a few taxes right off the top. And the price of salmon in 2015 was less than in 1974 when I started running my own seiner 41 years ago. That's not adjusted for inflation. That's just flat out less money. If I could support the governor's proposal, if the money would get appropriated to fish and game, so we could have so they could get the money to do their job. But I don't think that looking at the commercial fishing industry to plug the gaping budget hole is a realistic idea that some people in the state have. And the shortfall in our taxes, I think, has been somewhere around $20 million, supposedly, in what the fishing industry pays versus cost. I see in the Alaska Dispatch that one oil company in Cook Inlet got $20 million cash from the state treasury and the so-called tax credit last year, and it came to light because of a bankruptcy filing. But I support a statewide income tax, so everyone pays for some portion of the government, and obviously that alone won't pay for all the shortfall. But anyway, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Holm. We have Bruce Schockler in Kodiak.
He's not going to testify at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We will go to Seward. We have Rhonda Hubbard. And Ms. Hubbard, if you could keep your comments to 3 minutes or less. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, this is Rhonda Hubbard from Seward, Alaska. I'm with Cruise Out Fisheries, LLC. I'm going to launch right here. Ms. Representative Suit's request on why we don't have a tax on sports fish and the processing of such. Just to clarify, the fish taxes are actually an occupational tax, whereas if you were to do a sports fish or a tax on sport processing of sports fish, you'd have to implement more like a sales tax on that. And we basically, where you actually collect, account for, and pay a tax. In our world of commercial fishing, we account for values claimed, and then we pay the tax. So we're not necessarily collecting it as a processor from anybody, and we're the ones that pay that. Plus, we have fish tickets and a core report that Fish and Game and Revenue collate information to extract that tax from us. And so you'd have to come up with a whole different accounting system and maybe some terminologies too in your statutes for that. I'm talking about cuts. I would recommend that the departments and maybe legislature look into consolidating or co-locating our commercial fisheries and those that are connected. I'm thinking about the fish tax group with Department of Revenue and commercial fishing, ADF&G, CFEC, ASME, who work with the e-landing system, because all of that information is what the fish tax and all of those groups is what the fish tax relies on, all that data that's collected. They really need to be in the same room and not in different buildings, and they need to talk more. And with that, I would really suggest that the legislature task the departments with comparing the fish tax revenues and numbers from the fisheries business tax, and the fisheries landing taxes. Compare those with landing numbers of ADF&G, CFEC, and National Marine Fisheries Service, and make sure you got the right condition codes or disposition codes or production codes. Those are all different terms used with the different departments, although they mean the same thing. So there again, you have inconsistencies, and it'd be nice to get that streamlined and cleaned up for industry as well. But if you drill down into those numbers and do some comparisons, I think we're going to find some holes possibly or some areas that we can do a little housekeeping on and get a little bit more accurate and refined in how those numbers are streamlined between the different departments and that the state is actually getting what they deserve. I would also suggest that we look into the different tax types while we're doing this. I said before in my earlier testimony that these tax types and license types go back to 1962 or earlier, and they have evolved, the industry has evolved, and we really need to look at the different tax types and the amounts of taxes that we're paying and look at a floor tax on a developing fishery or some of these low-value products where they hit a certain price threshold and they're going to be taxed a minimum of a half a penny or a penny a pound. I think that would really help clean things up. So that concludes my testimony. Thank you, and I'm here for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone else online that would like to testify? Okay, hearing none, and Do we have anyone else in-house that would like to testify? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. There's no further business to come before this committee. We will meet again, on Thursday, February 18th, and we will hear House Bill 251 once again. And let's see, we will have, it doesn't appear right now that we have anything listed for Tuesday.
We have the schedule for Tuesday night. We want to move to Thursday, I believe.
Yes, we're going to cancel Tuesday and move this to Thursday. I didn't make myself very clear, did I? I'm sorry. So we'll see you on Thursday, February 18th, 10 o'clock in the morning, to hear House Bill 251. Thank you. With no further business come before this committee, we will adjourn at 10:49.